Hi, listeners. Welcome back to another bonus episode of Rock the Boat. Oftentimes, as Asians living in America, we forget that there are 2.5 billion Asians around the world, and that there are other English-speaking Asians who live in places like the UK, Canada, Australia, and so many more. Today, I want to bring you an international episode from a podcaster who takes the art of podcasting to the next level. His name is Jay Ui, and he lives in Australia. His podcast is called Choose Off, and in his show, he explores Asian-Australian culture. In this particular episode, Jay explores the impact of COVID-19 on Asian Australians and Australia's history of racism towards Asians. It's a highly thought-provoking episode, and it really makes me rethink America's history as well. You can check out Jay's show on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcast. It's called Shoes Off. All right, enjoy.
COVID-19 has brought out a lot of targeted attacks in Australia.
A lot of them are walking the sidewalk, people stopping their cars and yelling racial slurs at them, saying coronavirus, go back to China.
But where do these come from?
The arrival of the Chinese allowed these white people to unify and form a kind of government. But underpinning that unification was racial hatred and fear, a fear of difference, a fear of loss.
And why is it still around?
It was the lived daily reality as well as the public international face of Australia for the whole first half of the 20th century. Even then, it took until 3/4 of the way through the 20th century for it to be ended.
Hello and welcome to Shoes Off, stories about Asian Australian culture. I'm Jay Ui. We've seen reports, videos, and maybe you've had your own experience of racism during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's something that a lot of us Asians are dealing with at the moment. And at first, I didn't really know how to cover this topic. Racist attacks are happening, and yeah, it's bad. But what more is there to say? Well, today, I want to explore the roots of this racism in Australia.
When COVID-19 actually started in Wuhan, when it all happened, I was actually in Malaysia at that time by myself doing some self-traveling, and automatically I already knew that there's going to be some racial component in Australia.
That's Erin Chu, a writer and social activist who conducted a survey on Aussies experiencing racism due to COVID-19. This next experience of hers happened at an Australian airport when she arrived back.
A lot of us, I was wearing a mask, you know, as well, and a lot of people were wearing masks. So as I was walking out into the arrivals hall, I could see this Anglo-Australian woman. She's probably waiting for somebody from a different flight. And she kind of looked at all of us quite suspiciously. And so when I walked past her, I just happened to cough because I had a dry throat. And she said to me, "Can you please get away from me? I don't want to catch your virus." And she literally walked off.
Now, this might sound kind of like self-preservation, but it's important to note the language used. Your virus. This idea that the virus belongs to Chinese people. And again, this might seem almost understandable given that we think COVID-19 started in Wuhan, China. So why is it not helpful to call this, as Trump said, a Chinese virus?
First of all, even the World Health Organization has always stated that we shouldn't name diseases or any type of viruses after a geographical name. So if you call a virus, like Donald Trump did, the Chinese virus, what happens is people who have certain ignorance or who have certain ideas of what China means to them, they'll start generalizing that calling it the Chinese virus means anybody to me who looks Chinese, who looks remotely Chinese, must be responsible for this virus.
The naming of COVID-19 as a Chinese virus is problematic for a number of reasons. I think firstly, it implies that it is a disease related to people who are Chinese. And it is particularly problematic because when we talk about someone being Chinese in English, there really is no distinction between, you know, is someone actually a citizen of China? Do they have Chinese heritage and live in, say, a Western country? it sort of creates this sense that anyone who might look Chinese might be a carrier of disease and this virus. And that's without going into the deeply racist nature of the term itself. My name's Osman Chu. I am a research fellow at the Per Capita Think Tank, and I've worked in policy circles for the last decade or so.
So referring to COVID-19 as a Chinese virus means that anyone who just looks Chinese to someone else can be a target for comments and attacks out of fear that they have brought this coronavirus to Australia. It doesn't matter whether the person has been in Australia the whole time this pandemic has happened, or their whole life. Or maybe they're not Chinese at all, but to others, they fit into the category of what Australians think Chinese are. And now, all of these people can be targeted. Even Chinese migration to Australia is super complicated because the Chinese moved everywhere. Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Papua New Guinea, Cuba, Brazil, Panama, the list goes on.
So these are all diaspora communities, very similar to the ways that Europeans have their diaspora communities. So when they migrate here, the difference is, we wouldn't say to a Canadian, hey, you're to blame for Trump, right? Wouldn't say that to a Canadian. In fact, we probably wouldn't say it to an American with an American accent. We definitely wouldn't say it to a white person who just happens to look white. So I am Dr. Sophie Loy-Wilson, and I'm a lecturer in Australian history at the University of Sydney. So my area of interest is the long history of Chinese engagement with Australia. But you can imagine, you come here as an Asian-looking person. Often many Australians somehow think you're a representative of the communist regime or a Chinese spy. This is bizarre, absolutely bizarre, you know, that this is the case. It speaks to the prevalence of Eurocentric ways of thinking in our education systems. And it's all about the inadequacies of the person who is racist and the person on the receiving end of that racism. Very hard to educate someone if they're starting from the point that, yeah, all Chinese, you know, like you guys are all from mainland China. Oh, and by the way, you've all got coronavirus. You know, I mean, it's absolutely bizarre. Like, I know very little about England. I don't understand the Westminster system. You know, I don't know about the royal family. I'm partly from Scotland, never been to Scotland. I can't pronounce the names of the villages in Scotland, right? Can't tell you anything about Scotland. You know, that's because I'm not from Scotland.
So even the Chinese communities in Australia, their ties to mainland China can also be little to none. Yet, because they look Chinese, they can be a target. And in Australia, they have been.
There's been a fair bit of media reportage on examples of racist abuse that people have experienced in public places. Examples of spitting, even, you know, there's an example in Tasmania of a Hong Kong Chinese student who was violently attacked. But I think that's only skimming the surface.
Yes, and there are plenty of other cases. I'm sure you've seen some circulating on news websites, like the Melbourne student who was attacked by a white lady, or a Telstra store worker who was told to go back to their own country. Even vandalism of a Chinese family's property saying COVID-19, China, die. These incidences can be very unsettling for people who have nothing to do with the disease. In fact, as of the 18th of April, the Australian Government Health website shows that more than 80% of all cases have come from either Europe, cruise ships, or the USA, and not China. Erin and Osman started seeing all these attacks against Asians happening and not decreasing. So they decided to create an online incident report for people in Australia who have experienced racism as a result of COVID-19.
But if there's something for them that they don't need to internalize that within themselves, and for many people, it actually may be the first time they've experienced racism, whether it's just being called a chink, or whether it's been told to go back to China, or whether it's more physical. For some people, it's their first time. And to give them that opportunity to add their voice to some kind of mechanism, I think is extremely important.
There are, of course, other avenues to report incidences: the police, the Human Rights Commission, the Race Discrimination Commissioner. But these are much more formal processes. So Erin and Osman's survey is something quick and easy you can do from home. Within a week of the survey being live, they had over 100 responses, and this is just through online sharing. No federal or state announcements or anything of that scale. But why is this happening? Despite far more cases in Australia coming from Europe and the USA, why haven't we seen a similar fear of European-looking people? And why does me saying that out loud sound so outrageous when the flip side seems expected and almost normal here?
So I think there has always been this underlying anti-Chinese sentiment, and that kind of goes back to the 19th century in my view. So in the latter half of the 19th century, and Australia is not unique in this sense, there was a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment in those Western colonial countries, so Australia, New Zealand, Canada and the United States. But what I think makes Australia unique is that it was defining in a way that it wasn't elsewhere.
So, how was our anti-Chinese sentiment a defining feature of Australia? What is Australia's history with Chinese people?
So, Chinese people started arriving in Australia as early as the early 19th century, and they were brought here first as small groups of labourers, and they worked on farms, pastoral stations, and other properties as servants and shepherds, and then it leapt hugely in the 1850s with the gold rush. My name's Angela Woollacott. I'm the Manning Clark Professor of History at the Australian National University. And one of my areas of interest over the years has been that of the Chinese in Australia.
So there's actually evidence that the Chinese knew about Australia before British settlement. But if we're talking post-1788 settlement, the Chinese came to Australia starting in the early 1800s, with a bigger influx in the 1850s onward during the gold rush.
The first part of the 19th century was one of invasion of Europeans, invasion and great disruption for Indigenous people, great loss of life for Indigenous people through smallpox and frontier violence and disruption of loss of their livelihoods, and then very fast growth of these British settlements. So it was a period of enormous change.
Now, this gold rush attracted a lot of migrants to Australia, not just the Chinese. But the Chinese were definitely a target, so much so that state governments started putting restrictions in place to lower the number of Chinese people who could enter.
As historian Anne Curthoys, who's worked on the Chinese on the goldfields, has pointed out, when prospectors said, oh, the Chinese are taking too much gold, they didn't say that about other immigrant groups, like people from America or continental Europe. So there was very clear racism going on.
Why do you think there is this distinct fear of the Chinese immigrants versus the other immigrants that were in Australia at the gold mines?
We should probably see it as connected to religion. So in the 19th century, the British Australian settlers were very dominantly Christian, and with the Chinese people not being Christian, that was a very important factor. They were seen as pagan, as different, as other in that sense. Of course, language was a factor too, because very few British settlers here would have had any Chinese language skills.
I asked Dr. Loy Wilson the same question. Why was it particularly bad for the Chinese as opposed to other immigrants?
I don't think historians have adequately answered that question. I have spent my career trying to answer that question because I think it breaks my heart, frankly. So there's a wonderful book by the historian Marilyn Lake called Drawing the Global Colour Lines. She looks at what she calls white man's countries, you know, these settler colonies. And she looks at the introduction of anti-Chinese legislation, anti-Asian legislation. Her explanation is quite, you know, it's quite out there, but it's quite interesting. So, you know, she says that we wouldn't have the nations we have today without Chinese immigration. That actually, and Adam McEwen makes this argument too, that actually, if it hadn't been for this very large wave of Chinese immigration, this sort of motley crew of random white people from like random parts of Europe that have like random cultural backgrounds, like Scottish, Irish, different accents, that frankly hate each other.
That's what I thought.
Catholics couldn't marry Protestants. I mean, different villages in Scotland hated each other. Scots and Irish hated each other. Irish and English hated each other, right? So she argues that these guys wouldn't have banded together in these nations, right, Australia, if it hadn't been for the mutual hatred of the Chinese. So that the arrival of the Chinese allowed these white people to unify and form a kind of government, but underpinning that unification, like tying these strange parties together, was racial hatred and fear. a fear of difference, a fear of loss, you know? And she says it's because we didn't have a strong sense of unity in the first place. We'd taken Aboriginal land, wasn't ours. We weren't very good at farming it. We weren't very good at understanding it. We're far away from home. So why are we here? Well, the Europeans don't want us back. But if we band together against somebody else that we hate even more than each other, then maybe we can find a reason for being here and for taking over this land that's not ours. So this is her argument.
It's a very interesting perspective. And I guess you always kind of need a common enemy to some extent, and the Chinese serve that purpose.
You know, another argument, Jay, that comes out a lot is about jealousy. It still comes out today. It comes out, you know, with the HSC, right? It comes out with things about James, like the kind of like dog whistle of HSC results, and comes out with bamboo ceiling debates to this day as well. And it's about jealousy, right? And it's the idea that, you know, the Chinese were too successful, too hardworking, right? They showed up, they embarrassed the Europeans, and then the Chinese married the European women, the Irish women. This argument is, I think, you know, important. It does, I think, have some kind of legitimacy in that a lot of the racism that is directed towards Asian peoples is that jealousy is quite specific, right? It's like, how dare you work so hard? Like, my kid can't get into university because of your kid.
Okay, we're digressing a little bit, so back to the gold rush. So the Chinese were different in many ways: religion, language, dress code, and daily practices. But they were also very well known for working hard, even beyond the gold rush. More on our Chinese history in a future episode. And maybe it's because of their success, their ability to actually acquire so much gold, or maybe it's because they were seen as more different than the other Europeans, that the government started putting restrictions in place. The Chinese, as opposed to other immigrants, were positioned as the main competition for Australian resources.
And now, because of all these immigration restrictions that emerge because of anti-Chinese racism in the 1850s, the boat often couldn't stop in Sydney. It had to go round to Robe in South Australia, where Chinese migrants were allowed to dock, as a little town of Robe, and they would get off there. It's cold. It's the Australian bush. You're with your friends, and somehow you have to walk all the way from Robe to the Victorian or New South Wales goldfields. Now, this is a defining moment for many people. Are they going to survive? As they walk, they often find, you know, the bodies of their comrades. They find characters in Chinese on trees. You know, it's confronting.
The White Australia policy under the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901, the British Imperial Government said you can't just do it by race, partly because, you know, with the British Empire, including subjects of all kinds of races, you know, places around Southeast Asia and Hong Kong and so forth. So they just said you can't just exclude people by race. It was done by a dictation test. So this was something that Australian officials copied from Natal in Southern Africa. So immigration officials had the power when people arrived in Australia to make them do a dictation test in any European language. And they could just randomly choose a lesser, you know, like Hungarian or, you know, some European language that there was no way an arriving person might be able to know. So that's how it was actually implemented.
So a bit of history. Before 1901, each state functioned as their own entity, and this dictation test that could be in any European language was in effect in some states. But when we federated and became Australia as one whole country, this became a national policy. Picture it. Everyone celebrating the nation coming together, and one of the first things our new national government does is restrict Chinese people from entering our borders. Australia as we know it today began by excluding Chinese people.
What do you think we should learn from our history of racism?
Well, that it was such an integral part of Australian policy and culture for such a long time. And one of the things that I think is really important for us to realise and to be sobered by is the fact that overseas, other countries saw Australia as an overtly racist country for a very long time, you know, from the late 19th century right through to the 1970s. You know, people overseas would just look at Australia and see white Australia, this overtly racist country. And I think in that way, Australia historically needs to be compared to the Jim Crow South in America and to apartheid in South Africa. And I think for a lot of Australians, that's not a comfortable comparison to draw, but historically it is absolutely warranted and justified. And we need to see the comparisons. And of course, this is very much about the treatment of Indigenous Australians as well as migration policy. All of that is part of it. But I think Australians need to know, to be aware that we do have this very uncomfortable history of having been an overtly, officially, a country that privileged whiteness, prioritized whiteness, and put it front and center in our immigration policy.
You know, I think we're looking at something akin to slavery here in terms of the structural racial hatred that develops. It's one thing to have racism, okay, a belief that the Chinese are inferior, a threat. It's another thing to put that into law. So in Australia, we structurally translate our racism into a legal system that has the first colour bar that is saying if you are a certain colour or race, you cannot enter this territory. It is for white people. 1850, early Victorian history, Victoria, first place in the world to put that colour bar in place. Then we have laws saying the Chinese have to live in a certain part of the goldfield. They're segregated. Segregation laws based on race. So we translate this into law.
Yes, we have a very distinct history of legislated racial discrimination, and it's one we don't talk about enough. Our foundations are that of racism and exclusion, and we have yet to formally recognize this racism against the Chinese. But beyond trying to keep Chinese people out, there's more that was happening on our shores. So you were talking about venereal diseases in the Northern Territory. What sort of time period are we talking about here?
This is during the First World War that it becomes a major controversy. But from the early 1910s, and then I suppose concern about it is really whipped up through 1915, 16, 17.
This is Dr. Ben Silverstein, postdoctoral research fellow at ANU. And when we talk about venereal diseases, it's another way of saying sexually transmitted infections.
So it's from 1915 that the Commonwealth government starts to make this a concern or a more substantial concern. There was a large amount, a large proportion of venereal disease in the Northern Territory at this time, 1915-16. What I find really interesting about it in the Northern Territory, at least, is the way that it's represented. We might have a medical way of explaining the spread of syphilis, the spread of other venereal diseases. The way that they explained it was primarily as a consequence of what they would call race mixing. The spread of venereal disease was attributed often to the practice of Chinese men having sex with Aboriginal women. And then they would describe its spread into the white community by white men having sex with those same Aboriginal women. So you see this process, or at least this argument about a process of transmission from Chinese men to Aboriginal women to white men, and therefore on to white women. So it's really processes of race mixing that they blame for the spread of disease. And this is reflected in the way that they govern it. They start banning contact between people who they describe as different races. They ban sexual relationships, whether they're consensual or coerced, between Aboriginal women and non-Aboriginal men. And this is the way that disease is regulated. And I think we see that really often in a whole lot of settings, colonial settings in particular.
Yeah, and I guess it would stem from the idea that the white people are clean and these other people, coloured people, are dirty. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. The white people are clean and are not diseased until they come into contact with people who are described as of a different race.
Yeah.
It's the mixture that makes people sick or that spreads disease. And so once you attribute contagion to that, to move to a form of racial segregation as a way of preventing disease or preventing ill health to the white population becomes a logical move.
So race mixing was seen as a way that diseases were spreading to white Australians. Chinese people were the diseased ones who were spreading it to the white population. Do you see this as a sort of parallel to what's happening with coronavirus today?
Yeah, I think we see, particularly in the early days and weeks of the spread of coronavirus in Australia, or as it began to spread, there was this attribution of that spread to contact with Chinese people or with people who've returned from China. So we saw that panic among some people over whether you could catch coronavirus from eating Chinese food or from being near people of Chinese ethnicity. There wasn't a sense that contact with Americans or contact with American food or Italian people would cause contagion and the spread of disease. There was a sense that it was what was often termed as race mixing that would cause contagion, that would cause the spread of coronavirus.
So we also have a history of blaming minorities for diseases. But Australia now kind of prides itself in being a multicultural country. So why hasn't this history of racism gone away? Here's what Professor Woollacott had to say.
We are a very multicultural society, and in many ways, we're a very successful multicultural society. And yet the racism is there. And, you know, because I'm a historian and because I know just how virulent racism could be, such as the violence against Chinese miners in the Gold Rush and, you know, overt instances of racist violence on streets in Melbourne. I think my fear is that there's a kind of deep cultural well of racism in Australia, that the exclusion policies of the late 19th century that became entrenched in the White Australia policy, which was in force, and it was the lived daily reality as well as the public international face of Australia for the whole first half of the 20th century. And then even then it took until three quarters of the way through the 20th century for it to be ended. I think Australian culture has integrally included racism for so long historically that it's kind of been built into the fabric of Australian history and culture. And that when there's any kind of spark or event that brings fear and anxiety to the fore, or concern about equality, or, you know, the things that can trigger it, it's just, I mean, essentially, it's not too hard to scratch the surface in Australia and for racism to come to the fore.
I asked Dr. Loy Wilson about this idea of multiculturalism as well.
Look, you know, like all of us, I love the idea. It's a beautiful idea. I love it. Love the festivals, love the posters. Of course we haven't. Of course we haven't. With the existence of this ongoing kind of racial vilification, the danger that people of non-Anglo appearance experience in this country, of course more so in different periods of intense fear and anxiety like the coronavirus era, but also during 9/11 for Muslim communities and throughout the noughties for Muslim communities. We are not a multicultural nation, and using that word is offensive for those people. Because it says to them, what are you complaining about? It's multicultural. What are you complaining about? It's a festival dedicated to you. You know, we like your food. As Nassan Hodge, the theorist, says, it's superficial. It doesn't deal with the heart of the matter. It allows Europeans to engage in the ritual of racial harmony, the ritual of racial inclusion, you know, in eating yummy food, for example, going to a festival, without the hard work of what that actually means. You got to do the hard work, right? Got to do the hard work. And the hard work involves looking at your own privilege. You know, we have a country where structural privilege is given disproportionately to Anglo people and to white people, okay? So when privilege is divided in that way, you can't have a multicultural nation. It is a monocultural nation that allows occasionally other cultures to have sanitized expressions of cultural difference funded by Europeans, approved by Europeans, non-threatening to Europeans. So no, like I love the idea. I love the idea, but no.
I guess we've never really unpicked that sort of false creation of this Chinese other, and it's really been there throughout Australia's history after what Australia ended, this concern about, you know, being on the doorstep of Asia and this fear, that investment, this fear of constantly being taken over.
Right. And then COVID-19 is then allowing people to, well, it's bringing out this fear that they've had, and it's making it, I guess, that they're more likely to be overt about it. Is that right?
I would say so. And I think part of the issue is that people don't see it as racist. And this is a general problem in Australia, that And it's the constant retort you see that, oh, people are saying the reaction isn't one based on racism, but actually just fear. And it highlights that in Australia, we really struggle with understanding, you know, casual racism and systemic discrimination.
Yes, it's the sad reality that our history of racism against the Chinese and other minorities didn't disappear with the dismantling of the White Australia policy. Change within doesn't happen so quickly, and it only takes a spark to bring back some of the flames, and it's affecting a lot of Australians.
I don't think it's emphasized enough that the best estimate at the moment is that about 14.7% of Australia's population is Asian Australian. And I'm using that in a very broad sense and not just East Asian. But I don't think it's emphasized enough that that is the equivalent of the African American population of the United States. When we're talking about these issues, it's affecting a large proportion of the population. When you think of, you know, even just Chinese Australians, in somewhere like Sydney, that's at least 10% of the population. It's not like a tiny minority of people who are affected. It's actually quite a sizable and growing minority of, you know, Australians.
So COVID-19 has brought out a racist side of Australia that we try to pretend doesn't exist. And it's causing real damage to a lot of Australians. We're good at thinking we're not racist, but our sad reality is that our nation has a long history of racism, particularly against Chinese people. The Chinese have been painted as stealing our resources and spreading diseases in the past, all whilst being vilified for working too hard and outperforming the Europeans. And whilst we did officially get rid of our White Australia policy, deeply rooted racism doesn't just go away. And this coronavirus is just one way to bring it all to the surface. People suddenly think it's okay to target anyone who looks Chinese, even though most of our local cases are not from people who came from China. Writing this episode and chatting to all these people, it genuinely made me sad, not just because of the attacks, but because it's not the Australia I so wished we were. And it really spelled out our rather ugly history in a way I never fully realized. As much as I call Australia home, and it's the only home I've known, our history of racism, particularly against Chinese people, is something we need to be more aware of because it has shaped our country. But there's also a lot we can learn from the Chinese in our history.
But there's also a lot of stories of these men unionizing, these men contacting community members in towns in New South Wales, these men taking their employers to court for bad treatment. Very important to emphasize from the start that these men that came out as workers were not victims, that they often had agency and tried to claim their rights. And they get very good at operating under that surveillance. So kind of like ducking down, figuring out, you know, when inspectors are going to come past, figuring out what Europeans are going to cause them trouble. And also these guys were often armed. They had knives. They had what were called tomahawks. They had poles, you know, so they weren't kind of weak, you know, they were tough.
On top of that, the Chinese formed brotherhood organizations to protect their money and resources from theft and burning. In fact, I've hardly touched on the day-to-day racism the Chinese faced in the 19th century, and believe me, there's a lot. But despite this, they were resourceful, they banded together and fought the racism that they continually faced. And I think COVID-19 is a reminder for us that we can do the same. Know our history, understand the world we live in, band together, and stand up against racism.
So what do we do? Well, I think the thing we do is we do exactly what you do, and we try to understand, and we try to educate, and we just try. We just keep trying, right? And there are so many Asian Australian activists that like keep like banging their head against the wall. But, you know, I think people are kind of like beginning to listen.
Here's Erin and Osmond from the start of the show.
The racism is bad, but it has actually woken up the community that there is a racism issue in Australia. And many of those who may have been sleeping for quite a long time may have experienced something or seen experiences and read about these experiences. So in many ways, they've woken up to this issue. And I think in some ways, that's the silver lining of that situation.
And my hope is there's that realization that things like racism, discrimination still do exist. And I hope it can galvanize people so that we can go, okay, this has happened. What can we do to stop it from happening again in the future? And that's my hope, that it sort of awakens people and activates people.
That's Asians, COVID-19, and Australia's history of racism. This episode of Shoes Off was written, produced, and edited by me, Jay Uy. Special thanks to all our guests, Erin Chu, Osman Chu, Dr. Sophie Loy-Wilson, Professor Angela Woolacott, and Dr. Ben Silverstein, as well as Nadia Rook, who I couldn't fit into this episode, but you'll hear from her soon. There was so much I couldn't fit into this episode, like the lived experience of the Chinese in the 19th century, and how other Asian countries are dealing with COVID-19 compared to Australia. But I hope this has given you a glimpse into the complexity of race and racism here. Let me know what you think or what you would like to have heard more of at facebook.com/shoesoffau. If you liked Shoes Off, please subscribe. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, or head to shoesoff.net, where you can also find a bunch of resources mentioned in today's episode. And if you have someone you want to get on side when it comes to race and racism in Australia, please share this episode with them. Thanks, and catch you next episode.
Most Australians, politicians, leaders, immediately denounce racism when it occurs, and they have to, they need to, and it just has to be immediately crushed. It's so important for all leaders in Australia to denounce it the instant it raises its ugly head, and to say, this is not Australia, it's not okay, we are not that, and this has to be stopped, it has to be prevented, it has to be prosecuted. People have to be prosecuted for these instances. So I think it's crucial that our leaders do that. I think, you know, the great majority of them are very good at that. And I think the great majority of Australians aren't racist, you know, in a conscious way or in a regular way. But I think that culture is a very deep and complex matter, and that perhaps like sexism, misogyny, other kind of forms of discrimination, that even when ostensibly it's not there, it's not approved, it can come to the fore for reasons that are irrational or unfortunate and ought to be condemned.